And welcome to the regular meeting of the Board of Directors of the San Diego Metropolitan Transit System. I'll call this meeting to order, and before we start into our regular business, please call the roll.
Alvarez?
Yes.
Arambula?
Here.
Bragg?
Here.
Cole?
Here.
Cunningham?
Here.
Gomez?
Here.
Hall?
Here.
Mathis? McClellan?
Here.
McWhorter?
Here.
Sotelo Solis?
Here.
Roberts? Salas? Donovan?
Here.
Zapp?
You did call my name, I think. Here. All right, before we start the meeting, we have a little business here that there are occasionally times when people in our MTS family do something worth our recognition and appreciation, and I'm happy to say that we have two people here, one from the First Transit organization and another one from our code compliance group that we'd like to recognize. And so I'm going to go to the podium with Paul, and we'll explain it to you and make a presentation and have a photo taken. Thank you. I'd like to invite Aisha Booker to join me at the podium, if you will, please.
Thank you. Aisha is a First Transit bus operator. As you know, the First Transit people do our access and many bus driving, and she found herself in a situation, and she reacted in such a way that was extremely significant. So let me tell you what happened. Many of you may have already heard about Aisha's actions, but on July 17th, she was on her lunch break when she came to the aid of an El Cajon police officer who was a victim of a horrific assault that nearly took his life. While everyone else ran from the scene or stood in shock, Aisha quickly stepped in after the suspect fled and used the officer's police radio to call for help. It was this transmission that allowed police to expedite help, quickly arrest the suspect, and get medical treatment for the officer. Aisha's decision to help an officer in desperate need was a quick reaction and demonstrates her instinct to help others. So Aisha, I take great pleasure in recognizing you and thanking you for your service, and it's a pleasure having you here. Thank you very much. And so you'll know our appreciation and have something for you. I have this Distinguished Service Award presented by MTS. It was presented to employees who performed deeds of exceptional merit. It is with great pride that MTS recognizes Aisha Booker, your extraordinary action on July 17, 2017, to protect the life of another. Thank you. I'd like to invite the Code Compliance Inspector Ryan Berger. And as you can see, Ryan has a companion. Ryan is one of our members of our canine patrol, which we use for a variety of purposes. But the best part of it is we're not dependent on another agency to respond to a particular great need in which the services of the dog.
Can you hear me all right?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I should know better than that. So let me explain how Ryan is involved and what he did. Code Compliance Inspector Ryan Berg and his partner, Ashka, that's Ashka, graduated from the Transportation Security Administration's Canine Training Handler course on Wednesday, September 27th. Ryan was selected for the Top Dog Award, one of the only two special recognition awards. The Top Dog is described as follows. Your exceptional handler abilities rate amongst the top of your peers and reflect a great degree of dedication to your profession. Your skills will help provide the traveling public with the highest level of protection. Congratulations to our clients, compliance officer Burke, for congratulating at the top of your class. We are fortunate to have a canine officer with this recognition protecting MTS passengers. Congratulations, Ryan. And before we take the picture, I'd like to extend again this Distinguished Service Award for you to keep. Presented to employees who perform deeds of exceptional merit. Ryan Berg, great pride that MTS recognizes your graduation from TSA's canine training course and for being honored as the top dog. Congratulations. That was unable to make it this morning, and I should let you know the situation with him and why he is being honored. This is for Yohani Aguilar. Now, Yohani is a member of, he's not an MTS employee, but he's a member of the MTS family because he works in South Bay for Transdiv. In our South Bay operations. So let me tell you what this is all about. On September 22nd, Yohani was serving a Route 3 bus stop near Balboa Park on Fifth Avenue in Upas. A physical altercation began with two men nearby. One of the men was stabbed and significantly wounded. The stabbing victim boarded the bus, and Yohani drove him directly to the hospital. Yohani's quick thinking and ability to safely drive the victim to the hospital under stressful circumstances saved a life on this day. Yohani's actions were exceptional, and he is indeed worthy of this public recognition. Sorry he can't be here this morning, but we certainly see that he gets his award. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure when we can do that. We have some remarkable people, a lot of remarkable people working for us. And over the years that I've been here, we've had a number of remarkable occasions in which we've been able to recognize and give due appreciation to the people who have done it. All right, we'll go now to the business at hand, starting with number two, the approval of the minutes of September 21st, 2017. And I'll take a motion if no one has any comments. From Mr. McWhirter, is there a second? From President Cole, no further discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. We now come to public comments. So we have.
I don't think we have any.
Okay.
Okay,
we do have some public comment later, but we don't have any for under public comment for items not on the agenda. All right, the next item of business. Oh, I should tell you that we want to get to item 30 right off the bat, so we'll take that as soon as we finish the consent agenda, and we'll hold the closed session until near the end of the meeting so that we can get through this agenda. It's a very full agenda. So this is the consent agenda, item 6 through 13. Is there anyone who wishes to pull any of the items? Seeing none, I'll take a motion for approval. Mr. Cunningham, second by McClellan. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you. It passes. All right, we'll go now to item 30, and this is the zero emission bus discussion. And Paul, you want to lead off?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
We started this discussion at the last board meeting, and the board had requested that we come back at the next board meeting for a presentation, a more full presentation on zero-emission buses, with some requests for guests. And so Bill and Sharon will be doing the staff report. Next to them, the man in the gray suit is Steve Claremont, and he is from the Center for Transportation and the Environment, a nonprofit organization that is doing business, as you'll see, all over the country in zero-emission buses. And so he's kind of our objective expert that is here today. And next to him is Jack Katowski. Jack is the division chief of the Mobile Source Control Division of the California Air Resources Board, well known by Mr. Roberts, but his division is planning and implementing the Mobile Source Strategy for Transportation, and has been very involved with us in the transit industry over our discussions for the last 2.5 years about zero-emission buses. So with that, I will turn it over to Sharon and Bill to start the conversation.
Thank you, Paul, and good morning, Board of Directors. This is a fun and exciting presentation for me to talk about buses and to talk about new technology that's coming to buses. So we want to talk this morning about zero-emission transit vehicles, where the state of the technology is, and where we see it going into the future, and how we can bring that to MTS. Just by way of background, zero-emission buses and reducing emissions has been important for the state of California and transit systems for a very long time. It goes back to the fleet rule in the early 2000s, and as a result of that is when we chose to go to CNG as an alternative fuel path, and we're almost at 100% now with CNG. Also, along with that fleet rule was discussion about zero-emission buses and how we can get to purchasing zero-emission buses as early as 2018. And over time and over the past few years, that has remained one of the goals, but at this point is not in practice right now. As we wait for the technology and we work with the manufacturers and the technology suppliers to drive that technology to the point of it being commercially available and ready to go. So we've been working with, as partners in collaboration with many transit systems across the state, with the Air Resources Board, the California Transit Association, the Sierra Club, CTE, many different organizations have been involved in pushing forward zero-emission bus technology, and we've been participating in that as partners. There are many different kinds of complex issues revolved around zero-emission buses, but working with all of those partners and the bus manufacturers, we continue to progress very quickly, and you'll see through this presentation that it has advanced very quickly in the past couple of years and is doing so right today. And I want to add a personal note, and that is, as you remember, I came here about 4.5 years ago from the Midwest, and I have been so impressed with how far the state of California and the transit systems are in comparison to many other places in the country. I came from the Midwest, and I talked to transit systems at the APTA conference who are attempting to go from diesel to CNG today. And that's a big leap of faith for them as they try to go to a more clean fuel. And we're already at CNG and talking about going to zero emissions. So California has been very impressive, and I'm really proud to be a part of that. There are 107 zero-emission buses in operation in California as of September. And this data comes from the Air Resources Board that tracks these pilot programs. And you can see that there are 20 fuel cell buses in operation and then 87 battery electric buses in operation in the state of California. And for the most part, these are in pilot programs. There are a huge amount of benefits to zero emission buses. obviously emissions reductions. Zero emission is what it says, zero emission from the bus, and that is very important. According to the EPA, the transportation sector accounts for about 27% of GHG emissions, and transit accounts for about 6% of that. So we are a significant and considerable part of emissions reduction and cleaning up our air. So we continue to work on that, and so I want to talk about zero-emission bus technology and how that can be a big piece of emissions reductions. There are other potential benefits with zero-emission buses, lower maintenance costs, better energy efficiency, lower total cost of ownership, noise reduction, battery performance. So there are a variety of other potential benefits of zero-emission bus technology. And as you saw in the previous slide, there are several transit agencies that are now piloting these systems and looking for those benefits and identifying how those are working for them. I do want to just point out that at this point, zero-emission bus technology in fleets is at a higher cost than the standard CNG or diesel bus fleet, but the trajectory of the technology is such that it continues to become more and more in line with what we see on a standard bus system. So there are a couple of major types of zero-emission bus technology, and the first one is the fuel cell. And this has an onboard fuel cell that converts hydrogen into electrical energy to operate the bus. So it combines hydrogen with oxygen and does a chemical transformation onboard the bus. You can either fuel with bringing in a truckload of hydrogen and you can fuel from the truck, or you can actually build the infrastructure and build a hydrogen plant on site and make your own hydrogen with water and electricity. There are people at the table, and I'm sure Steve would be much more able to explain that from a more technical standpoint, but there's a lot that goes into the hydrogen fuel cell bus, but it is one alternative for zero-emission buses. AC Transit, Sunline, and Orange County are currently piloting those buses. The more prominent zero-emission bus technology being used in the state of California and across the country are the battery electric buses, or BEBs. This has onboard batteries that store electrical energy from an off-vehicle charging system, so you do have to have an infrastructure that allows you to charge or fuel the bus from your facility. And again, the majority of transit systems are looking at battery electric bus technology to fulfill their zero emission solutions. So staying on battery electric buses, then there are four major manufacturers of battery electric buses, but there are others entering the market. And we saw some of those at the annual APTA show. But the four major bus manufacturers for battery electric technology are BYD, Proterra, New Flyer, and now Gillig. BYD and Proterra may be familiar, may not be familiar. They are exclusive battery electric bus builders and have been in the market a little bit newer than compared to New Flyer and Gillig, who are the more standard traditional bus suppliers. But New Flyer and Gillig are also now beginning to get into battery electric bus technology. And again, this is very high level, just like my hydrogen bus description, and there are other people who could do probably a much better technical job. But I looked at this from a simple standpoint. If we took one of our current CNG buses, essentially we would remove the engine and transmission and replace it with an electric drive system. And that is fueled by electricity instead of CNG. And so if we took the CNG tanks off of the bus, replaced those with batteries, they would hold the fuel or the electricity for the bus. And that's a very simple explanation. There's a lot more to it than that. But from the standpoint of comparison from a high level, that's pretty much how it works. There are two types of fueling. If you've been around an electric car, you know that you have to plug it in to recharge it, and that is called depot charging or slow charging. So the bus has to be plugged in. The bus is in a stationary position at the charger from somewhere between 3 to 5 hours for, and typically overnight, so that you refuel the batteries so that it's got a full charge and a full fuel level to go out the next day. There's also fast charging, in-route charging that's been developed. Principally, that's because right now battery capacity and battery storage on board the bus is not equivalent to current transit buses. So they use the in-route charging to add charges throughout the day at like a transit center. And I'll have a couple slides on that in a couple of minutes to explain a little bit more. But essentially, you're building infrastructure at like transit centers or layovers so that the bus can pull up, sit there for up to 10 minutes, and get a quick charge to refuel. Yes?
Could we save the questions for last?
Okay.
I want to get them through the presentation. Thank you. Go ahead.
So the depot charge again is where you pull the bus in at the facility and you plug it in and it sits in a stationary position and recharges and refuels. The range is rapidly increasing for all manufacturers. There are battery technology companies, energy management companies, as well as the bus manufacturers who are making rapid advances in increasing the storage on board buses, and that's a huge plus for the industry and a huge plus for zero emission buses. Obviously, there's greater flexibility in setting detours and setting routes and being able to move your service if you're not having to do the in-route charging. It avoids additional cost of the in-route chargers, and we'll see a couple of those in a second. Again, one of the cons is right now a battery electric bus with depot charging is not equivalent to the maximum range of a CNG bus. But certainly the technology is developing and the bus manufacturers are working hard to bring those up to equivalent standards. There are fast charge in route systems. A couple of bus manufacturers have their own structures, and then there's another one that's more agnostic to the type of bus. These can extend the range and keep buses out for the entire service operation day by using quick charges at transit centers or layovers, so it replenishes some of the energy that gets used. We do think that this may be transitional technology from our perspective, what we've seen, because as the ranges increase through depot charging and onboard capacity, that systems that are putting in in-route charging today, that may be transitional technology and may be obsolete at some point if capacity on board the bus gets closer to the CNG bus range. It does require some infrastructure. Here are some examples. New Flyer and Proterra have developed their own overhead charging system for fast charge. So you can see in the photos here between New Flyer and Proterra. So when you pull into the transit center, there's a structure with an overhead charging that connects to the roof of the bus, and the bus sits there for about 10 minutes, gets a fast charge, the charger disconnects, and then the bus can continue on. There's also wave technology, which is an agnostic system that's been developed that can be applied potentially to all four of those major manufacturers, and it uses inductive charging for the fast charge. So you actually reverse that and you put the charger on the bottom of the bus and you put the charger in the pavement. So when the bus pulls up to the transit center, it sits over the top of the wave charger. And I've got a picture of that in a couple of minutes. And the bus sits there for about 10 minutes and it gets its fast charge from bottom of the bus instead of connecting at the top. The most common application today in the pilot programs and the deployments that we're seeing is a combination of depot and in-route charging, and that's principally because of looking for maximum range of the buses. If a system has buses that go 300 to 400 miles on certain routes, they're going to have to use some in-route charging to be able to extend and go the entire day on those routes. It does provide the longest daily range and gets closest to being able to duplicate what a CNG bus fleet does on a daily basis. So I wanted to use a quick case study and show you what we saw at Antelope Valley. Antelope Valley Transit Authority is in Lancaster, California. It is a mostly suburban commuter type of service that runs into Los Angeles, and they were one of the first systems to decide to go 100% zero emission battery electric bus deployment. They're working on that today, and they've spent the last couple of years building their infrastructure and preparing for that. So they have 80-bus operation, and what you'll see in the photos is they've built a depot charger for each of those 80 buses so that each bus can plug in overnight and refuel. They do have a 15-acre site, and you're going to see in a minute why that's important to how they do depot charging. And they're also putting in 13 of those in-route wave chargers so that they can do in-route charging, because they've got some very long routes that go from Lancaster all the way into downtown Los Angeles. And then finally, they've also installed a backup diesel generator so that if the grid did go down and they lost all electricity, they could fuel up to 25 buses a day in an emergency basis. So here's what it looks like. On the left-hand side, that is the depot charger, and it looks a lot like if you've seen the electric car chargers, it looks a lot like that. So they have one of these, and then you can see in the top photo on the right, they've put all of their depot chargers on the perimeter of their facility so that they're able to back in each bus and connect it, and then the buses can charge overnight. And then in the bottom right-hand corner, those are the depot charging stations for their articulated buses. They didn't want to be backing their articulated buses into spots for slow charging, so they've built some drive-through charging stations for their articulated buses. This is their Wave induction fast charger. It's located at one of their transit centers. And so that disc that you see in the two left-hand photos, that's actually the induction charger in the ground. It kind of looks like a manhole cover. So the bus pulls up into this lane at the transit center, it sits there, and the charger on the bottom of the bus connects with the Wave charger, and it does a fast charge to refill the batteries with some electrical energy. And then the other two photos are the controlling equipment that goes along with a Wave charger. So this is at one of their transit centers, and they intend to put 12 more of these in around their system. And then finally, this is that generator that I talked about that'll allow them in an emergency, they could refuel 25 buses a day and keep some level of service out there if there was a complete shutdown of the grid. So that's sort of the state of, as we see, zero emission bus technology. As staff, we believe that the next step is to do a comprehensive pilot and put together that program and bring that back to you so that we can bring buses in and we can run them through and demonstrate some of the things that you've seen here, the benefits, some of the operating characteristics. These are the things that we think we would want to demonstrate. There are obviously cost components, there are cost savings, and there are additional costs that we'd want to work through. But the operational characteristics, the range, the fuel efficiency are also very important to putting service out every day. We would be able to look at how does the San Diego climate, how do our route profiles, how do our passenger loads, all of those things, how do all of those affect our ability to operate these buses in service? And how do we deal with the infrastructure of facilities? And then maybe most importantly for a pilot is how then do we scale that up so that we can go to full deployment of zero emission bus technology? And that's what we've seen in our peer transit systems as they're implementing those pilots, so that they can do those proof of concepts in their systems so that they can prepare themselves for full deployment, which is pretty exciting. There are a couple of things specific to San Diego, or specific at least to large transit systems. We've certainly talked about it in the past, about the electricity rates in San Diego are among the highest in the state of California. A pilot would allow us to work and partner with San Diego Gas and Electric on electric rates and find some creative ways to address those things. One of the most important things the pilot would do is help us work with battery manufacturers, bus manufacturers, and technology companies to find a way, how would we do this in full deployment? So I talked a little bit about Antelope Valley with their 15 acres and 80 buses. We are pretty much the reverse of that at all of our bus facilities, and that's not uncommon for urban transit systems. For example, our IAD facility, which is about three blocks from here, is almost the reverse of Antelope Valley. We have 174 buses for 8 acres. And so this is what it looks like on a typical night. So working with the battery electric bus manufacturers, infrastructure companies, and technology companies will be really important working through that pilot so that we can find ways to fully deploy that at our bus facilities where we park, which is called nose to tail, shoulder to shoulder, with very little space in between the buses. And if you remember those depot chargers, you have to find a way to get the charger to the bus. So the pilot, again, would give us that opportunity to try to work through those issues and work with the industry as a whole to drive us to being able to do full deployment of zero emission bus technology for MTS and across the state and then across the country. So I'm going to turn it over to Sharon, who's going to talk about some potential pilot financing so that we can be prepared to present you with a pilot program.
So everybody in the state that's doing pilots is doing so with some extra grant money because it is costly. This is, we don't want to sugarcoat that the pricing for this right now is still not where CNG costs are. So they're looking at a number of different possibilities for this. Certainly SB1 money, you know, if the initiatives that are being proposed right now do not pass, SB1 will, you know, continue to flow, and that might be an opportunity for us. There's also a program that CARB has, which is the Hybrid and Zero Emission Truck and Bus Voucher Incentive Program. This is an incremental bit of the difference between the ZEB and CNG bus cost. It's not a lot. It's currently it's somewhere between $95,000 and $110,000 per bus, but it is a first come first serve competitive process. So we would have to obviously submit an application for that. It's unclear yet what CARB intends to do with the VW settlement money. That's another possibility. Federal 5339C is a program that is a federal program for low or no emission buses. That's where a lot of these California companies are going to get their pilots funded. They just awarded this month, so we would have to go through the next cycle, which should be next year. And then finally, cap and trade and the low carbon fuel standard credit program. These are also programs that are state programs. We're already discussing with, for instance, for the Affordable Housing Sustainable Communities program under cap and trade, how could we possibly work with a developer of affordable housing to help implement this? So we're already talking about these kinds of things. And then the credit program, this is a credit for your use of the electricity once you do start the program, and you can sell those credits on the market. So these are the types of things that people are using. I do want to mention to you that, again, the staff recommendation is just to direct the CEO to complete a plan for zero-emission bus pilot program and return to the board with a recommendation for its implementation. With that, I'm going to now turn this over to Steve Claremont, and he's going to give you a kind of more specific discussion about the technology.
Much for having me here today. Let me get my thing going here. Again, my name is Steve Claremont. I'm with the Center for Transportation and the Environment. Let's see, that's not showing up right. That's interesting. Anyways, our organizations, for some reason my slides aren't showing up as they are on my screen. Let me just do this maybe instead. Try that, maybe that's a little better. Anyways, the Center for Transportation and the Environment, our goal is to advance clean, sustainable transportation technologies. We've been in operation for well over 20 years. We are a nonprofit. We are an independent resource. We get our funding from federal funding sources such as the Department of Transportation, Department of Energy, EPA, NASA, Department of Defense. So as such, as we go through our projects, we believe we are custodians of federal dollars, and as a result, we maintain our independence of what's taking place there. We do work nationally. We have offices in Atlanta, that's our main office, as well as Berkeley, Los Angeles, and St. Paul. When we get into our projects, We provide a full scope of services from feasibility studies all the way through procurement, deployment, and follow-up on reporting. Really, our primary objective in these services is to educate the transit agency on the technologies that they're purchasing. This is a paradigm shift from what they're currently used to. So we spend most of the time communicating and understanding why these technologies are different and the best practices for deploying those technologies. We've worked on a number of zero-emission bus projects across the country. The items in blue are projects that we are either currently working with today to deploy zero-emission buses, or they've already deployed zero-emission buses. Okay. Might be fine now. There's my little. Maybe just in that one slide.
Yeah,
all right, we'll try this now. The orange dots are transit agencies that have recently awarded with the LONO funding that will soon be under contract and working with them. I do like to kind of go over where the market is today. This graph shows zero emission bus sales in the U.S. For the past 8 or 9 years. In total, there's about 1,200 buses. As you can see, with any new technology, one of the things that you like to see is that hockey stick effect, where you have it's kind of a slower adoption rate, and all of a sudden there's a rapid adoption rate to the technology. So this is a good sign that there's a lot of interest in the technology. But with 1,200 buses and 140 agencies that have gotten awards for zero-emission buses, each of those agencies are purchasing small numbers. So this is telling you that they're all doing pilot projects at this point. There are several like AVTA that are planning for a larger scale deployment over time. But initially the point where we're at is really pilot projects. Another interesting development about the market, you can see in the top little table, how the sales have changed over the years. In 2015, we basically doubled the number of sales or awards from the previous 5 years. 2016 doubled 2015, and 2017 is on par to double 2016. Over that same period of time, the base bus of a battery electric bus has changed from 1.2 million to about 750,000. At the same time, the amount of energy storage on that bus has nearly tripled or quadrupled. We're much higher than 300 kilowatts on many buses. Same thing with fuel cell electric buses. Back in 2011, they were about 2.2, and now we're down to 1.2. So we see that trend continuing with both battery electric buses and fuel cell. So what is the key to being successful with your project? And before you start deploying any buses, obviously, you need to go through a planning exercise or a pilot exercise. As Bill pointed out, there's a lot of variability or differences in the technology. There's in different battery configurations, charging configurations, and the charge rate as well. Another key element to success or planning is understanding your requirements for your transit agency. There's too many transit agencies that rely on what has happened in other transit agencies and assume that they're going to have the same level of success or use the same type of metrics. That's just not true. Every agency is different in the way that they operate their buses. Every agency is different with respect to their topography and climate, and these all have impacts on your requirements. Finally, in going through the planning process, we believe that you'll end up with a better understanding of how to deploy these technologies into service. So to start with on that planning process is to conduct a technology assessment. So this is where we want to look at how the various types of zero-emission bus technologies can meet your service needs. What are the impacts to service? Again, these are different type of buses. They're not going to operate the same as your CNG buses. You may need more buses to produce the same level of service. You may have to, if you have en route charging, say, have a time where you always have to charge. So that's going to impact the timing of your service. Also, your facilities, you know, what type of capacity they have to take on zero emission buses. And finally, fuel cost. This is can be very different from agency to agency because you're relying on your local utility and your local fuel rates. So why do we go through this process? Because fuel efficiency and range can be impacted by passenger loads, the climate. Unfortunately, you're in a very good climate here. The route profile, so the topography, the speed of the route, the number of stops, acceleration, deceleration, battery degradation over time. We're all familiar with how batteries degrade in our cell phones. Battery electric buses are no different. And then finally, operator behavior can impact your efficiency. I want to bring up a tool that we developed to kind of illustrate these factors in battery electric buses. Give me one moment. So let's say, and you've probably heard about different ranges out there. So let's say you have a bus that's proposed to have 304 miles of range on it. Now, assuming that that's with the driver only, assuming that you want to actually carry passengers, maybe you have a half load or a full load. So see that. Sorry about the screen size here. Let's make it a little bit bigger if we can. So that 304, when I changed it to, you know, being half full of passengers, full of passengers, we went to 248 as a range. Now, and that's on a flat, fairly flat surface. You do have hills around here, so let's say we give you a moderate grade. So with that 248 just went down to 211. And let's say that's, you know, you're running this on an urban route, and now we're down to 111 miles. And let's say now you have to run the heater on a cold day or something like that. So, yeah, so you got a hot day, a cool day, or a hot day, you're running HVAC. So again, range is changing here. So as I said, this is just for illustrative purposes only. But the point is that you really need to do the analysis on your routes before, and not assume that what somebody else is getting in another part of the country is going to apply to you. All right, let's go back here. We'll show you, so how do we understand your routes? We use a tool called Autonomy, which was developed by Argo National Labs for the heavy-duty trucking industry, and we've modified it specifically for battery electric buses. So using a tool like this, we take parameters about your routes, parameters and specifications on buses to analyze your routes and calculate what the energy efficiency is on a number, and we do a sensitivity analysis based on HVAC and passenger loads as well. And that provides us with basically a tool that we can start having a conversation about energy efficiency and what that bus can do, and produces a result like this. This was done for a transit agency where they were looking at battery electric buses, where they put a bus into service at 5 in the morning and comes out of service at 10 o'clock at night. So they're currently using a diesel hybrids to do this service right now. So we took one of the buses they were looking at, we did the model, and that bus would actually run out of battery at about 7:30 in the evening. That's on a good day. On a bad day, it might run out of energy at about 1:15 in the afternoon. So what do you do with a route like this? Well, you can put a second bus out there. So now instead of one bus, you have two buses. Or you could put on en route charging. And this profile would change so that the battery wouldn't degrade. It would be able to last the whole time. Now you're dealing with en route infrastructure. So these are the challenges that we deal with when we go through the modeling. Also, as battery degrades, this curve then shifts over. And now with a degraded battery, an older battery, maybe on a bad day, you can only make it till about 10:30 in the morning. Now, I do want to point out that for this particular agency, we put the same bus on a different route, and it operated fine all day long. So it's highly route-dependent, as well as all the other factors that I just mentioned. And that's why it's so important to do the analysis up front and take the time to understand this before you go through a full deployment of these type of vehicles. Infrastructure planning. Bill mentioned all the various types of infrastructure that are out there, but doing the planning up front is important. Site selection, where can you put the charging infrastructure or the fueling infrastructure if it's hydrogen? Capacity planning and utility coordination. So if you're doing overnight charging at your depot for the 174 buses at that particular, does it really have enough energy? Does the utility have enough energy to supply that depot to charge all those buses? And likely not at this case. So we look at, you know, how much energy is available at that depot and how many buses can we charge and how many different charge windows can we charge overnight. Redundancy and contingency planning. Again, you saw the generator at AVTA for their overnight charging, which would supply 25 buses. So again, here we're dealing, it's a scalability issue. How do we plan? What's our contingency plan if it is battery electric? Of course, with hydrogen, we see that as solving a lot of problems. Unfortunately, it's very expensive right now, but it does operate very similar to how your CNG operation would be. Scalability, we've talked about that. Parking, staging, yard operations, again, AVTA with parking around the perimeter, they had plenty of space. With the parking that Bill showed, there is a challenge there, and maybe we have to install, if you're doing overnight charging, overhead gantries to get the charge cords down to the buses. Data networking, charge management. Again, we're seeing that charge management is going to be critically important, especially for overnight charging. This is where you can schedule buses to charge within a window and perhaps have some dynamic scheduling to prioritize bus charging. But this means there's a whole data networking, IT infrastructure component to not only adding charging equipment, but you're adding IT infrastructure. Of course, when you actually get into the project, once you've decided what to do, there's planning, design, permitting, construction, installation, commissioning. These all take a lot of time. We often find that it takes longer to put in the infrastructure than it does to build a bus. So coordination with vehicle delivery is important. If you are going with a battery electric bus, you don't want the manufacturer to deliver that bus before you have your chargers ready to charge them. Once you do have buses, of course, you know, there are more best practices, deployment planning, there's operator training, maintenance training, first responder training. Again, you may have to adjust or make enhancements to your service or your routes, and that results in a whole communication effort with your community. When you do receive your buses, we do like to go through a validation period to validate the models that I mentioned before. Because you'll make some decisions based on the models. You'll make service decisions, routing decisions, and operational decisions at your depot. So we want to reconfirm that what they've delivered to you, what bus they delivered to you will achieve the objectives. Finally, after they've been deployed, we typically take our customers through at least 1 or 2 years of what we call deployments analysis or benefits realization. You're buying these buses based on the benefits. What's important is that you analyze how they're performing in comparison to those benefits. Once you understand their performance, you can then take action to ensure that you are realizing those benefits. I want to thank you for your time this afternoon, this morning, and available for questions either now or later. Thank you.
We're going to now have Jack Katowski from the California Air Resources Board. He's going to talk a little bit about what they're working on.
Thank you, Sharon. Good morning. Chair Mathis, Supervisor Roberts, members of the board. So I'm going to, my name is Jack Katusky. I'm chief of the Mobile Source Control Division at the Air Resources Board. So I have a combination of regulatory and incentive oversight. So if you, the carrot and the stick are proverbially in my hands here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about CARB's efforts related to transit, and transit's a really important aspect for us moving forward. We have done a number of integrated and holistic plans on how we plan on reaching our air quality and climate goals, and transit is a key partner in all of those. It's not just the emission benefits that were talked about before. Transit plays an important part in that technology transfer from the light duty to the heavy duty sector for zero emission technology. It really is a beachhead in trying to move that technology forward. And of course, transit is really important for us in terms of enhanced mobility, in terms of SB 375, and having livable communities and reducing VMT for private citizens. So it really is all around an important category. In 25 years of overseeing regulatory items, I have never seen a sector transition and move as much during the regulatory process as this has. The growth in this sector of zero emission buses has been amazing in the last couple of years, as you've seen from some of those graphs. We've gone from a couple of dozen buses to now, as was stated, about 450 buses in California in use or on order. We've seen price reductions and utility improvements. So there's absolutely been amazing growth and opportunity. We've gone from just a couple of manufacturers to all major bus manufacturers now have zero emission bus options. Several of those in California, with coming to California and producing California jobs. We've seen progress on infrastructure, and we've seen six transit agencies that have committed to 100% zero emission by 2030. So we have seen a remarkable change here, but it isn't, there are still issues, and I think that's what you're seeing here is there is a process that needs to be go through a logical, methodical process. Upfront cost was mentioned. The upfront cost is still a concern for many folks, although full life cycle costs can be comparable or even beneficial. And this is very dependent on the individual region we're seeing. San Diego has particular challenges, as was mentioned, with your utility costs. In other regions, we've seen the utility come to the table and have submit proposals for the PUC that would provide infrastructure funding, reduce demand charges, and reduce electricity rates for the transit agencies. So that is hopefully something that San Diego can incorporate in their process as well. There are certainly questions moving forward in terms of was mentioned incentive funding. Air Resources Board currently offers about $100,000 per bus. That's intended to be not defray the full cost, but intended to be a sort of quick and easy, you know it's there, it's a voucher program, so you can sign up and grab it while you're trying to put together a comprehensive funding package. We're trying to make that easy and accessible to you, and we have a proposal that we will be putting to our board in December that will actually increase that dollar amount from $100,000 to about $150,000 per bus. And so we look forward to that taking another leap forward in terms of this technology. So for the last couple of years, we have worked with the transit agencies, and specifically Mr. Jablonski has played a key role in that part in terms of chairing the transit subcommittee, in terms of getting on the same page with the transit agency. It has been a very learning experience as we try and sort of figure out this industry that's rapidly evolving and changing. We've certainly seen differences among the transit agencies, and a one-size-fits-all is not something that works well for transit agencies and their individual characteristics, especially as we're looking, as Steve was talking about, in this, as you're trying to do a transformation, not just reduce emissions, but really transform an area. There are lots of issues and differences among the regions. So we're looking very closely at that. As we move forward with a regulatory structure, we are looking to certainly have a clear end goal of a zero-emission, clean, robust transit fleet, one that meets the local community's transit needs, the needs of the disadvantaged communities, especially in these areas, in the local regions, integrates enhanced and unique mobility options as folks are trying to integrate how to integrate new mobility options in their regions and incorporates that. We want a clear goal of a zero emission future, but we understand there is a transition. So how do we get there? And so we're looking at that sort of early period where there is a regulatory push but a heavy reliance in the early period on incentive funding to help launch this industry even further, and a sort of commitment to continue to work with you on how is this transformation happening, how is it working out, and how do we move that technology so it's successful everyone, because you know, when you're successful, we're successful too. We're all, you know, that your success helps clean the air, and so we recognize that. So that's the extent of my comments. We are looking to continue our regulatory efforts, but move to our board next year with a package, as I said, that will provide that nudge in the early years, but have a heavy reliance on incentive programs. And we look forward to continuing to work with you.
So that concludes our presentations, and the recommendation is on the screen for you, and we'll be happy to take any questions.
What I'd like to do is limit the questions so we can get on to the public speakers and then back to a regular discussion. So if you have any questions to clarify something that you don't understand, we'll help you better understand it, and we'll start with Mr. Hall. Mr. Hall, and then I'll get to you.
Yeah,
had his hand up much earlier.
My first question is the fast charge. You know, I have an electric car, and I drive it home, and I get the basic 18 miles, so I can drive down here, but I can't make it back. And the fast charge, when I go home, I plug it in, and if I'm there for about 2 hours, it's fully charged. But I don't think you're talking fully charged, are you? By fast charge, you're just saying, yeah, we'll go another 100 miles or 40 miles or 20 miles.
Right, yes. The fast charge it's also called opportunity charging, and it's designed to just refill what may have been used on that trip. And it's typically like 1% for each minute. So for a 10-minute charge, you would put 10% back in to run that trip. Yes.
Right, so you're constantly plugging in at that point.
With the fast charge, yes, the connection either on the roof or underneath, yes.
But I'm using my own mind on that one. And then the break-even point. I know they're $250,000. You get maybe $100,000 back, so you're out $150,000. There are infrastructure costs. There's electrical costs, and I don't think people will do that. I know the other part, when I originally had a hybrid, it took 5 years to break even. And I'm looking for a break-even point. Are we going to be into 2096 to break even, or where are we with that?
So when we've done these assessments, life cycle cost assessments for other agencies, it's really going to depend. It comes down to your utility costs. And your utility costs are going to depend on what your charging profile is, whether you're charging during the day and or charging over at night. Remember, you know, with the fuel you currently have, it's based on a single rate. You can predict it fairly well going into the future. With your utility costs, you've got a fuel that where the cost changes by the hour of the day of the week, and then the week of the year. Could all be very different. So when we do the analysis, we actually look at, you know, when you're charging for an entire year, and then we do our calculations to build into that. So it's really tough to say until you've done the analysis.
Okay. All right. And then the last question, the biggest problem electric car owners has is distance anxiety. So you hope you make it there, and you're crossing your fingers you're going to make it there. The whole time you're doing it, you're trying to say, where's the next charging station? So we would the idea of Santee, you would to go driving around Santee, La Mesa, you know, El Cajon, you would have to have charging stations out there because there's no way you could charge at night and make it out there and back.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's planning and understanding the routes. I mean, up front, we plan to put those routes only on routes that you're going to be successful with, and we're going to look at, you know, new batteries, old batteries, and all the varying conditions that bus might experience. And so then it would be your decision on how you would operate that bus given the range parameters that we would provide in the model. So yeah, I'm not as familiar with your routes as they are right now, but if it's something that would require en route charging to give you that opportunity to charge to make you and to ensure that you would get back, that would be among consideration.
Mayor Salas, I apologize. You may recall he had raised his hand earlier during the
That's right. I forgot about that.
Go ahead, Mayor.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. So my question has to do, if maybe the three of you, whichever the best can answer this question, but it has to do with a proprietary aspect of the charging systems and infrastructure. And that's a little scary to take on because you're pretty limited on who you can deal with and how you can negotiate prices and all. Is there any change in the fast-moving technology that moves away from the proprietary aspect into kind of a universal charger?
Yeah, the major bus manufacturers have been discussing that for at least the past year to 2 years. It's certainly their intention at this point to try to make it more universal. I can say that the overhead charging, the in-route opportunity charging from New Flyer and ProTerra are going to be much more difficult for those to be non-proprietary. The wave charging, the induction charging in the pavement is agnostic in that any of those four bus manufacturers can use the wave charger, but even then the onboard electrical management systems are slightly different. So while they can all use the wave charger, there has to be some software changes on each bus to be able to use a wave charger for multiple types of bus manufacturers. So it continues to be an issue that we watch. I think at the pace with which things are changing, it's certainly our hope that the industry is going to realize that, because certainly bus procurements can be a significant issue, as you're saying. If a system buys a certain bus manufacturer today and 5 years from now, finding a way to not have to duplicate that same charging system is an issue. The depot charging is much closer to being universal. They all do take the same plug-in. There are some changes on the onboard battery management systems that have to occur, but they all do accept the same depot charger at this point.
So you're just kind of going towards my second question.
Well, I just want to clarify a couple things that Bill just said. So on the Bill mentioned there is a charge standards committee, and we participate on that committee. So on the overhead, actually, New Flyer's system is provided by Siemens, and actually, so it's a third-party product, and Nova Bus, I believe, is actually using the same system. Proterra has unleashed the IP on their overhead charger, which would allow other manufacturers to incorporate that. I don't see that they're going to go in that direction, that any other manufacturer would pick that up, because there's an underlying philosophy on the complexity of the system that none of the OEMs agree on. With respect to plug-in charging, this has actually been a very positive development over the last year or so, is that they're all trending toward some SAE standards on the plug-in for DC fast charging. So that would be Proterra, Gillig, New Flyer, and Nova Bus. All are going to a standardized plug, so you could have interoperability there. BYD uses AC charging, not DC charging, so they are the outlier. Their plug is an international standard, but you could not use that with any other bus.
Thank you. So I wanted to get to another issue in terms of the space required for charging stations at our facilities. So the wave technology is flat, and is there any downside in using that wave technology so that when they go to the charging facility that each bus has its own like manhole charger? Right. Under
just cost. Considering, and I think Bill had the numbers up there, about $350,000 per unit, plus substantial installation costs as well, whereas a individual DC charger might be on the order of about $40,000 to $50,000. So there's a substantial cost variation to those type of systems. So it'd be very challenging to put that. Though more convenient from an operational perspective, right now I think it is some cost issues. And also the biggest issue with doing depot charging, again, on a larger scale, is can the utility deliver the amount of energy that you need overnight?
Thank you very much.
There's also an added cost to the bus as well if you set it up to do not just depot charging, but you set it up to do this type of charging. When we met with the manufacturers at APTA, they mentioned that to us.
Okay, I'd like to get it on. Mr. Roberts.
Well, first of all, Stephen and Jack, I want to thank you both for being here. I saw your presentation at Atlanta last week, Stephen. And, the analysis and the modeling I thought was excellent. That would be beneficial for us. With the council members Cole and Gomez, we spent a lot of time in trying to absorb everything we could on these electric buses over the few days we were there in Atlanta. But thank you both for being here. Jack, I've worked with for many years at CARB, so thank you for taking the time to come. The question I have, when Sharon gave her report, you almost had the impression, my God, there's so many sources of money, we probably won't have to pay for any of this. And you mentioned, if I recall, the Volkswagen settlement, the SB1, the greenhouse gas money, and maybe something else. And Jack, you mentioned we're at 100,000 per bus now. Very likely, I think that would be increased to 150 at the December CARB meeting. Can you explain a little bit of all these different fundings, and can we expect that maybe, in addition to that, we might be able to access other funds in addition to the $100,000 to $150,000 grant from CARB?
Let me start this, and then I may need to hand it off to others as well. So there are two sources of funding that I think are very clear. And I don't want to say easy because no funding's ever quite easy, right? But what was mentioned, what we call the HVIP program, you see up on the screen, that we're proposing in December to bump up to about $150,000. And as I mentioned before, that's designed to be easy and straightforward, so you can put together, a transit district can put together their own funding mechanism and then have an extra $150,000 help to make that balance. I'll also just then jump to the bottom one, the low carbon fuel standard. That is part of our low carbon fuel regulation, and there are greenhouse gas benefits from the fueling of an electric vehicle. That is, whether it's light or heavy, there are less greenhouse gases for an electric vehicle than there is for a combustion vehicle. And that gets monetized in the low carbon fuel standard regulation in the form of credits that the individual transit agency can then sell. At this point, with the dollar amount that the credits are selling at, that value is about $100,000 over the life of the bus, so over the 12 to 14 year life of the bus. So it isn't something that you get up front, but every year based on your usage, you could get credits, and that's about another $100,000. Volkswagen settlement, I will just say there's $423 million in NOx mitigation funds that we have just started a public process on, and we will be going to our board in spring of next year. We have an informational item next week, actually, in Riverside, but we will be going to our board in the spring of next year with a plan on how to allocate those funds. Those funds are intended to mitigate the harm caused by the Volkswagen defeat devices on their diesel 2.5 and 3 liter vehicles. So it is a NOx focused program, and we need to get NOx emission reductions, and there are constraints that the broader settlement program that was negotiated with EPA has placed on that funding. But I don't think, but transits is certainly an area that is applicable for those funds. You guys are probably better equipped to talk about LONO and SB1 than I am.
Well, I can mention, we've repeatedly mentioned that there's initiatives to rescind SB1 in the state. So that's kind of up in the air until November of 2018. But we also, the LONO are very small grants. This cycle, only one California property got one, and it was, I think, for maybe $1.5 million. So those are very competitive. They always have many times more applications than they have money. So that's not a big source. Cap and trade, again, these are very competitive. A lot of the affordable housing, sustainable communities grants have many, many, many applicants and very few who get it. And then that would be also subject to a lot of variables, whether or not the developers want to spend it on this versus, you know, adding transit service or paying for fares for the residents of the affordable housing. So the cap and trade funding, as well as the federal 5339C, is always based on appropriation, which is an every year appropriation. So you're going to have to, you know, hope that you get a year when there's a lot of it available. So yes, there are variables.
Okay. We'll go to public speakers then. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Alvarez, you have a question.
Yeah, I have a few questions. Is the bus voucher program from CARB automatic? If an agency buys one, you automatically give them the $100,000?
You have to apply. There are some constraints around it. Has to be a bus on our list. But for the most part, yes, as long as we have funding. We were privileged enough that the legislature provided us with $180 million in voucher funding for this next year. That's not just buses, that is trucks, and I should mention the voucher for fuel cells is over $300,000. So if there was a fuel cell bus, that would be significantly higher as well. But yes, as long as there's funding and $180 million, we expect to last us well through this fiscal year and into next.
Okay. Just for clarity, the future potential funding through CARB or even existing, does that include infrastructure assistance at all?
There is some infrastructure assistance in there. It depends on the program. Sometimes we do competitive
programs, which definitely include an infrastructure component. The fuel cell has an infrastructure component. We're still trying to work out the details on whether an infrastructure component would be available in the traditional voucher, HVIP voucher. It's it like the other, if we did it, it would be a sort of a part of the solution, but something to help to easily grab.
Still wasn't very clear to me.
Sorry.
Whether you have that or not.
At this point, we don't. We okay. are looking at it for those categories.
Okay, thank you. And then, is there any assistance for cost for the cost of studying or analyzing the potential conversion?
That's the one area we don't have very much funding for. What I was trying to get at the other answer is sometimes the legislature provides us funding in a way we can use in competitive solicitations.
Right.
We did that last year. We had $60 million that we provided in a competitive solicitation. When we do that, then we have people are allowed to submit more rounded proposals. This particular funding is strictly buy a bus, get a dollar amount back.
Thank you, Jack. Last question. You might not know the answer to this. The Energy Commission, they also, I think, do some funding of infrastructure. I think they've done it with our port here locally. Are there opportunities there?
Yes, they are. We coordinate with the Energy Commission. They have an annual planning process that they are concluding for this fiscal year, and then they will be starting that process again next year. But the Energy Commission is a viable choice. And as I mentioned before, in most other regions of the state, the utilities as part of SB 350 are actually stepping up and providing funding for this infrastructure.
That actually takes me to my next question, and I don't know who could answer that. SDG&E, I saw on slide 19, you've mentioned, and this is a staff presentation, so maybe it's better suited for our staff here, but the electricity cost of SDG&E is higher here, or our electricity cost in San Diego is higher than other parts of California. How much higher is it? You make mention of the higher than CNG comparison, it's 50 to 100% higher, but how about compared to traditional utility companies? Do you know?
I don't have the exact number, but we are the highest in the state. And I'll get back to what Jack mentioned about the utility costs. Each utility has to provide the PUC with a program of what they're gonna fund and offset. Every other utility is looking towards infrastructure for electrification for transit buses. SDG&E is not. They're yeah. looking at port facilities and other things instead, and there's no indication that they're planning to do that. But for electricity costs here, I think we're 21 cents.
Above.
A blended rate of 22, which kind of blends your peak use rate and right. your regular use rate.
So 22 cents above like the average in California, is that what you mean?
No, that's what ours is.
Okay.
And yeah. then the
cool.
others are,
well,
I have
for
that
example,
in here.
Sacramento, I think, is about half of ours.
Okay. That gives me an idea.
And if you go to someplace like Florida, it's like 4 cents a kilowatt.
Right.
As opposed to us at 22.
So, Sharon, I appreciate you the feedback you gave, because there was just a hearing that I was unfortunately unable to attend. I think about that infrastructure that SDG&E was submitting to the PUC. Is that that's in like what among the spectrum, among the time frame of that decision? Where is that?
Well, I think you're referring to the event down in Chula Vista.
Right.
So that's when they get public comment on
right.
their proposals. I don't know when the final is for Jack. You may know that.
I believe it's. The utility split their proposals into two parts. One's an early action, and then the other is the full package. The early action, I understand, is this year, or it's imminent, something like that. The full package is like spring of next year.
Okay. So maybe there's still time to submit public comment. Do we know if community choice had anything to do with some of the other agencies or transit agencies going into electrification of their fleet? specifically someone mentioned Antelope, but I don't know if there's other of the agencies. Do you know?
So we're already in a direct access program, which is similar to that. Community choice aggregation is more for residential and like commercial communities to do, yeah, such as what Solana Beach recently approved. But we're already in a program where we buy through direct access, which is a similar type of program, but we're using it as a corporation or transit agency.
The direct access for like the trolley electrification or for what?
All of our electric costs.
Okay. I'm just wondering if the others had something to do with them. Are we a member of CTE or not? No, okay. So who is going to do our either feasibility study or our cost benefit analysis of what we're going to, how is that going
to
work out?
We would have to do a procurement through our regular procurement regulations, but we feel we could do that fairly quickly.
Okay. So what's the anticipated time frame?
For the procurement of that particular,
yeah,
services? For our TOP, which we just completed, when we went out for bid for that, I think it took us about 3 months,
okay,
from start to finish. It really depends on how elaborate the specifications are when we get into it.
And do you anticipate MTS staff providing a lot of the sort of data on the front end to be able to expedite the actual analysis from the consultant firm? Like,
yep,
we know which ones are flatter, which routes are flatter, which ones are longer, right?
Yeah, similar to with the transit optimization,
right,
plan, we used a lot of in-house resources.
Right.
So our scheduling department, our planning department, operations, our maintenance, you know, we've got a lot of data that we use every day.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Telesolis, followed by Ms. Gomez, and then Mr. Arangula.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again, staff, for the presentation. Actually, some of the questions that I had were actually just answered, but I'm curious, Paula, was the 4 cents negotiated with their agency, or is that just how much electricity costs?
Just the cost of electricity.
Okay. Would be interesting just to see, again, you just mentioned that being part of a package that we negotiate, I believe you said, is a corporate entity with SDG&E. Who knows, maybe there's an opportunity for a community benefits agreement to lower it just for this type of plan. So, and also too, you mentioned the VW funding opportunity. I mentioned it the last time I was here, so I'm really glad that it was, you know, just looked into. I know there are some restrictions, and just like anything, there are restrictions, but I'm really glad to see that the impetus is, let's see what is out there and move it forward. Because we can always say that there's going to be obstacles and hurdles and because it's cost prohibitive, but if we put our money and invest it in longer term benefits, you know, I would like to breathe, and my children want to breathe healthy air, and I think it's again speaking very positively via this report. The question for the I guess the procurement of the report and or assessment, you mentioned the app that you use. Can you share what the name of it is again?
Yeah, our modeling software, it's a product called Autonomy. It was developed by Argonne National Labs for the heavy-duty trucking industry. It's used also by all the major car manufacturers, but we modified it specifically for zero-emission buses.
Great, and I think that the diversity of locations, I think it's really important to look at those high ridership entities and the municipalities, again, thinking further on down the line, 3 steps down, really looking at the permitting process within each one of those municipalities. And since we're all from diverse spots of the county, I think it's really important just to put seeds in the head engineer, public works department, or even asking us to work with our fee schedules to see if this is something that is placed within one of our cities, again, National City being one of the high riderships, and if one of our routes is chosen, really seeing how we can either expedite or offset, or, you know, just really think creatively on really making something happen. So whether it's a fast charging station or a booth thing, the photo was really nice, but whatever that looks like, really making sure that our public works and our infrastructure is ready to handle that. And then just lastly, who are you looking at potentially building it? Again, I'm already thinking five steps down the line, but are there entities that are already, you know, available to do that externally, or is that something in-house that we would do?
Well, for the pilot, our thought is that we would hire someone like CTE to help us put together that pilot. The bus manufacturers certainly take the lead in helping with the infrastructure, but yeah, typically you have to hire someone for the extra infrastructure as well, and that would be part of the whole project. And one of the things that I personally am hoping, having watched this, is that through the pilot process and as the technology continues to rapidly improve, and we can help with that through the pilot, that the need for those kinds of extra infrastructure and on-route charging systems goes down, and it's certainly my hope that we wouldn't even need any.
Right.
That we can find ways to do certain routes and scale that up over time, so that by the time we get to the routes that run from Chula Vista to Santee, the ranges are such that we may not even have to do the en route, but certainly if we have to do that, we have to work with municipalities on all kinds of things.
Yeah, because there's definitely, as technology improves, I think it's really an opportunity to even talk about pipeline, because if we even, timeline-wise, it takes 3 months just to get, you know, an agency on board, you know, to get the procurement process done. I think if we even start talking to our high school STEAM programs, again, the partnership beyond just ridership and the physical infrastructure, if we start thinking about how do we feed that
piece. I think we're getting into
a
discussion here rather than questions.
No, I understand that, Mr. Chair, but I think it's really important that as we're looking at it as a whole, whoever does the assessment, it goes beyond just MTS as partners and really including others to have that voice, because as technology advances, we're talking about a set price now, but if it's going to get cheaper, then we need to have those voices at the table too, whether it be, again, the building trades, smart cities, partners who are getting those
grants.
Is
that a question?
Yes. Thank you so much.
Okay. Ms. Gomez, and please, let's limit it to questions for clarification, please.
Yes, got it. Two questions. One, in regards to the pilot, I think you had a slide on the pilot, just overall what we're trying to achieve. Yeah, what I remember of from our trip, I remember that there was the opportunity to look at lease versus purchasing. Is that part of the pilot as well?
Yes, that would be something we would look in the pilot as well.
Okay. And then
especially for batteries.
Yes. Oh, yes. I just wanted to make sure, because I didn't see that in there, or maybe I'm just missing it. But and then secondly, I know that electricity is a big issue. And I get it in terms of the cost and efficiency. I don't see any reference to working as well with the utility departments to work on trying to see if there's any potential to reduce the cost or you know where I'm getting.
Yeah,
this.
We will definitely. In fact, we've already had conversations with them over the past couple of years about this. Let's just say they haven't been receptive yet.
Yes. Okay. Wanted to make sure.
And one other thing I would say, and this is not the comprehensive outline for the pilot program. We were just trying to put together what we think would be the major components.
Okay.
What we plan to do is come back with that pilot program, which will talk about battery leasing, which will talk about purchasing of buses and the timelines that are involved in that, and utility and all of those things.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And then lastly, I just thought of the other one. In terms of the pilot itself, looking at its implementation of where we can, if we are to implement something like this, I would want it to be perhaps in an area that is a disadvantaged community, an area with a high ridership, just to, if it works. I know the distance and all of that, you know, we need to calculate all of that, but I just wanted to put it out there.
So in answer to that, there's a lot more funding if we put it in a disadvantaged community. So we're already aware that that's important. But, I mean, we have a lot of disadvantaged communities that we serve, and they're some of the best routes for this type of technology.
Yep. Just wanted to say it. Thank you.
Mr. Rambula.
What's the anticipated or envisioned breadth of the program, the pilot program, meaning how many buses are we looking at, and when are we anticipating the rollout? For how long is that pilot program going to be running until we reassess it?
Some of those are things that we're going to come back with when we bring back the actual pilot program itself, which will identify some of those things. You know, one thing we did find out at the APTA convention is that right now all of the manufacturers are at least a year out on their manufacturing. So we're probably looking at beginning of 2019. If we were able to order a bus today, it's 12 months out. For a battery electric bus, for example. So the time frame of the pilot from today to when buses are here, it's a period of time. And then one of the things that we'll do as we develop that pilot program is we'll talk to organizations like CT about how long should that pilot run and what are those key points where you make those assessments and evaluations. So and some of the pilots have been running for some pilots have been running for 4 years, some have been running for 5 years, and some of them have just started.
And approximately how many buses are we looking at?
We haven't decided that yet either for the pilot. Some pilots have ranged from as small as even one bus up to some pilots are running 10 buses. And some of that's going to depend upon, as we look at how we want to do the pilot and how many buses we would need to run that pilot, the infrastructure needs. Some of that's tied to infrastructure as well.
I would say, I mean, I think Bill's right. I think we want to wait to do the assessment, but I think we're probably talking about a minimum of 4 to 5 and maybe up from that. I mean, possibly up to 8 or 9. Some of that may depend on the funding, okay, not only just for the bus, but, you know, the more we get, the more infrastructure we'll have to develop. At some point in time, we're going to exceed electrical capacity. Then we'll have to talk to SDG&E about boosting that. So a lot of that will go into place. We also may want to get a fuel cell bus in here also, because right now, in terms of meeting our operational needs, a fuel cell, while the fuel is expensive, the bus is expensive, the bus prices come down substantially, fuel is still expensive, but it does have the benefit of being able to operate like we do now. I mean, we could send it out at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it could come back at 2 a.m., and it could go all that way. So it may be a combination of both battery and electric and fuel cell buses that meets the needs going into the future, depending on battery technology development. So all those things we want to put in, and we want to be able to test, you know, we want to be able to test the full gamut of our operational environment, you know, from the heavy routes, from the urban routes, to the many stops with many people, stop and go, to some of the, you know, the higher speed routes, like the BRTs or I-15. So we can get a range of the performance of these vehicles. And only when you understand the range under the different operating environment can you come up with a plan for transition. So
one last comment. I'd like staff to include in its report back to this board likely displacements.
Yeah, would you put that in the form of a question, please?
Yeah, so can you please? put in that report likely displacements of current employees and proposed options to avoid layoffs, especially any large-scale reduction in forces, perhaps cross-training, lateral moves, or something similar to that. We shouldn't lose staff that we've had for a long time if this is going to be part of that program.
All right, thank you very much. Well, I really didn't want to get to the speakers now. The first speaker had requested a formal presentation. I demurred on that, but I, as part of a compromise in conjunction with one of our board members, I've agreed to a little more time, and that'll be Ray Pingle, representing the Sierra Club. You have 10 minutes.
Good morning, board members, staff, and guests. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Ray Pingle, and I'm representing Sierra Club California. I'm the lead volunteer for the club's CARB Zero Emission Bus Rulemaking project, and I'm also a member of CARB's ZEB Work Group and the Cost Modeling Subgroup, and have served on that for nearly 2 years. I serve on the same committee with Bill Sproul on that as well. At the last board meeting, Mayor Salas basically asked the question, as the procurement was being considered for CNG buses, well, shouldn't we be considering electric buses? And at that time, Mr. Jablonski replied, I guess the short answer is no, and I'll try to explain why. Well, we're in a different universe in this board meeting than we were last, and of course, we're delighted to see the proposal on the pilot, but I would like to respond to some of the comments that Mr. Jablonski made and provide some updated current data. So on adoption at the last meeting, he mentioned that he was estimating about 200 electric buses nationally, and we heard from Steve that there's about 1,200 right now. CARB's report shows that there's 107 zero-emission buses operating in California today, with another 340 either on order or have been awarded. So it really is that hockey stick that Steve showed. It's really accelerating quite rapidly. There are 39 of the 39 transit agencies in the state that have 50 or more buses. More than half either have or are ordering zero emission buses. So there's a very rapid transition happening within the state. I'm sure you all know about LA Metro, 2,500 buses, a quarter of the state's buses, by far the largest in the state, second largest in the nation. And they made a commitment to 100% zero emission buses by 2030. Another a small agency in Stockton, San Joaquin Regional Transit District, with pioneering Donna DiMartino down there, made a commitment, their board made a commitment to 100% zero emission buses by 2025. And there's others, Foothill Transit, 332 agency, 100% by 2030. I wanted to talk about bus range. So Mr. Jablonski at the last meeting said within the last year, the average has been most about 100 miles on a charge. So bus ranges have really increased dramatically, as some of the other speakers have pointed out. And by the way, I just want to say, I want to compliment staff on really an excellent presentation, and Steve and Jack's comments as well, very good. CARB did a survey last year that said the average, there are 56% of bus routes are less than 150 miles. So I don't know what MTS's specific routes are, but just as a reference, Proterra now has a line of buses with ranges up to 426 miles. These are battery buses. New Flyer, the largest leader in the largest market share of buses in North America, has a 284-mile bus. BYG just announced a 45-foot commuter bus with a 225 range. And just like EVs, bus batteries are continuing to dramatically come down in cost, increase in density, and allow larger ranges. And I do understand the many good points that Steve made, that those are nominal bus ranges, and there's a lot of variables that you have to take into account in terms of what the real range is. But a lot of good things are happening in range. On bus capital costs, over the last 4 years, the bus costs have come down dramatically, as Steve pointed out, $1.2 million to $750. And this trend is continuing. And all the analysts, the bus makers, CARB has done a study on battery costs, forecast continuing decline of the cost of buses. For example, they're estimating that the cost will come down another $100,000 because of the batteries within the next 5 years. LA Metro, in its recent procurement, bought something like 60 40-foot BYD buses, and when you take the cost of the inductive charging out of that bus, the cost of that bus is $661,000. So we're already seeing some of these costs come down even faster than forecast. And then the HVIP program, which has been discussed. This is really exciting. Bless you. This is really exciting because the HVIP program had been $95,000 to $110,000, but it was a competitive first-come, first-serve, and it was underfunded. Last year, they had $21 million. It was fully subscribed, and they had a $13 million waiting list. This year, as Jack points out, the legislature, because the cap-and-trade program was reauthorized by a majority in both houses through 3030. The funding from the GGRF funds, from the auctions, are now really fairly well assured as anything can be through 2030. So they were able to increase the funding nine times from $21 million to $182.5 million. So it's expected that even though it had been on a first-come, first-serve, certainly in this year, and I believe and I think everyone does, that for subsequent years, transit agencies can largely count on the availability of those HVIP funds. And it's the amount is $150,000 to $165,000, which will be voted on next month or December by the CARB board. And then they also came up with a new incentive category for 60-foot buses at $175,000. So that's all very good. So the HVIP is a very important incentive program. On operating costs, Mr. Jablonski indicated that at the last meeting that it costs about $8,000 a year of CNG fuel costs to run a bus, an electric bus. He estimated $18,000 a year, so it's substantially higher, more than double. So on fuel costs, it's absolutely true that of the five largest utilities in California, SDG&E has the highest rates, absolutely true. However, having said that, according to the CARB battery electric bus charging cost calculator, the annual electricity cost per bus in SDG&E territory that's depot charged would be $14,800 a year, so less than $18,000. And then the LCSF credits that Jack mentioned are hugely important on this. So at a CARB workshop, CARB estimates that the credit that you can get per bus per year for an electric bus is $9,000. So if you subtract the $9,000 from the $14,500, you get about $5,800 is the cost of electricity after the incentive for electric buses. So now instead of the fuel costs being more than double, they're actually less. They're about 30% less for an electric bus than for a CNG bus. On maintenance costs, and y'all have some documents that I passed out that has more detail than I have time to do here, but on maintenance costs, according to CARB, the maintenance costs are about 30% less. So the total annual fuel and maintenance costs for an electric bus are expected to be about $12,000 less per year than a CNG bus. And it's because of these operational savings that helps cover some of the upfront additional cost. On total cost of ownership, CARB's June Innovative Clean Transit Workshop, staff showed that the net overall positive total cost of ownership at a state level, assuming all the transit agencies migrated to electric buses by 2040, there would actually be a savings of 2.6%, or about $580 million. They also did studies by area, and again, because of SDG&E's higher electricity costs, for MTS, the total cost of ownership would be more. It would be 1.4% more for MTS, or about $15 million, than it would be for CNG. However, that total cost of ownership model did not include the HVIP financial incentives. So if you put in the HVIP financial incentives and you just assume that that's used through 2023, you get a total cost of ownership of break even. So I think economically, we're really at a time with these rapid improvements that transit agencies can move forward and not have a huge financial burden on it and maybe even save money. But it'll all depend on a very specific analysis that you do. And there are also many other, we talked about other incentives, but one of the things that hasn't come up is with electric buses, you can install solar. Good news. So you can install solar on-site. If you don't have enough room, you can do it off-site. And when you do that, now your cost of electricity comes down even lower. And you get a double benefit from that because you're using 100% renewable energy. The carbon intensity of that fuel is zero. And so CARB provides a higher LCSF credit. So instead of getting $9,000 a year, you can get in the neighborhood of $12,000 a year. And if you produce your own electricity, of course, you have 100% zero criteria pollutant and greenhouse gas emissions. The other thing on the infrastructure is under SB 350 passed last year, the investor-owned utilities, including SDG&E, have to file applications, which they've done in January, to pay for the infrastructure upgrades for transit agencies and for heavy-duty trucking. And for example, SCE and PG&E set aside...
Your time is up, sir, so please wrap up.
Okay. Actually, I'm just about done. So the point is that with these LCSF credits, HVIP credits, you can do it cost-effectively now. And I would really recommend that MTS staff meet with SDG&E because they're ready, willing, able, and wanting to come up with financial incentives to pay for the financial upgrades of the infrastructure to the depot and also helping out on the chargers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next speaker is Gretchen Newsom, followed by David Grubb. 3 minutes, Gretchen.
Thank you. Good morning. Gretchen Newsom here again on behalf of 3,400 working families, power professionals, and electricians of IBEW 569. I'm here today to speak in support of the remarks and facts given by Ray Pingle of the Sierra Club, California, and to highlight the opportunities presented by MTS developing a pilot program for transitioning to 100% zero emission buses. As I previously stated last month, MTS was a leader in transitioning away from dirty diesel buses to make progress in reducing air pollution. And now MTS has an opportunity to continue that leadership with zero emission buses, a much better option for our communities and environment. But there's also the opportunity for creating good paying jobs. California is the electric bus manufacturing capital of America. Just to name a few of the manufacturers, there's Proterra, with a corporate office in Burlingame, California, and a factory in the nearby City of Industry, and BYD, with a factory in Lancaster, and Green Power Buses, and Complete Coach Works, and Phoenix Motor Cars, and Motive Power Systems, and Adomani, all with factories or corporate offices in California. Additionally, transitioning to 100% zero emission buses will create additional electrical infrastructure jobs. These are good paying jobs created to upgrade electrical infrastructure and to install chargers for electric buses. This is in addition to the jobs that will be created to build additional solar generating plants to provide 100% clean renewable energy to transit agencies with electric buses. These are middle-class, good-paying jobs that can create new training and career opportunities for those in disadvantaged communities. We believe MTS would be well advised to prepare a plan and begin transitioning to zero-emission buses. There's so much potential for a 21st-century transit system that works for all San Diegans, and today you get to begin to move toward that potential. Thank you.
Thank you. David Grubb, followed by Anna Reynoso.
Good morning, commissioners and chair. My name is David Grubb, speaking for the Sierra Club. I'm going to be very brief, and I'm going to look at this from a long view. When I was a boy, which is a very long time ago, one of the things that I and my friends liked to do was to go down to the railroad station and watch the train come in and out. It was a steam engine, one of the last of a dying breed. We were all sad when the last steam locomotive was replaced with a diesel. Just as the external combustion steam engine faded away, the internal combustion engines we use today will soon be museum pieces. Quite apart from the greenhouse gas issues and the health impacts, the laws of physics and economics will send them the way of steam engines. No matter what fuel you choose, burning that fuel in a modern power plant to make electricity and using the electricity to run a motor makes better use of the energy contained in the fuel than burning it in an internal combustion vehicle engine. So those factors alone are going to drive zero emission buses regardless. So as the board of a transportation agency, you need to understand that transition is coming and you need to plan for it. So we strongly support your plan for a pilot project. Thank you.
Thank you. Anna Renoso.
Good morning. My name is Ana Reynoso, and I'm here on behalf of the Environmental Health Coalition. If you don't know what that is, the Environmental Health Coalition has organized and advocated with San Diego community members for 37 years to achieve environmental and social justice. So the Environmental Health Coalition supports the action to direct the CEO to complete the plan for a zero-emission bus pilot program and return to the board with a recommendation. We also ask that the pilot program be in an environmental justice community that already experiences disproportionate exposure to the emissions from transit systems. Low-income communities of color experience the greatest exposure to pollution from transit systems and many other sources of pollution, making zero-emission buses that much more critical to disadvantaged communities. In San Diego, disadvantaged communities are often located near freeways and major roads where greenhouse gas emissions and other pollutants concentrate. Two-thirds of the communities that live near the busiest roads in San Diego, those carrying more than 200,000 vehicles on an average day, are people of color. As an example, National City is currently home to 32 million pounds of hazardous substances compared to La Jolla's 3.8 million. Pounds of hazardous substances. And in City Heights, the EPA respiratory risk data from 2009 shows that City Heights residents experience a 4 to 5 times greater risk than a neighborhood considered safe. These staggering numbers are due not only to these communities' proximity to busy roads and freeways, but also due to a lack of focus in these communities for green energy projects such as this pilot program. Further, in San Diego, low-income people of color are the majority of transit riders. This means that disadvantaged communities are both transit's most loyal customers and those facing the majority of the polluting impacts from transit. Other transit companies have conducted similar studies with positive results, as you have heard from practically all of the speakers today. But one example I do want to bring your attention to is King County Metro in Washington, which conducted a study regarding the feasibility of transitioning their entire fleet of 1,400 buses to zero emission buses. They found that it was feasible, but what I want to bring your attention to is that they found that placing these buses in communities most impacted by air pollution would have the greatest impact on air quality for everyone. So EHC believes that NTS could acquire the same benefits from this pilot program and the subsequent analyses on benefits for disadvantaged communities. For this reason, EHC suggests that you not only move forward in conducting this pilot program, but that you focus your efforts in the communities that need it most.
Anna, your time is up.
Okay. I just want to say thank you again to the MTS board for considering this action. San Diego clearly needs a forward-thinking approach in our transit system, and we're really excited to see that MTS is taking that lead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, that was the last of our speakers. We'll go now to a discussion, and I would ask you, in the interest of time, to please focus on the recommendation of the staff. Who's up first? Ms. Gomez, please.
Yeah, I'll try to keep it quick. But I actually want to thank Paul and staff for giving me an opportunity to join you all in the conference in Atlanta. I think I've learned more about the public transit industry than I ever thought I would learn. But I'm happy about it. I'm actually very grateful for the opportunity. I understand, I more than ever actually understand why we've been cautious, and I want to acknowledge that. There's definitely a lot of challenges in terms of the industry evolving very rapidly, and we have to be mindful of that. But I do think that we have an opportunity to introduce something that would get us to eventually overall transforming our whole fleet, wherever that is. So I definitely value the importance of starting small to get to overall changing our full fleet to whatever that will be in the future. So thank you for being mindful and for cautioning the board to not act when we could have, because I do understand, you know, where the electric buses were when it started and where they are now. And I think to really use our money smartly, I think implementing a pilot now makes sense. I do want to make sure that we do it in a smart way. I definitely want to make sure that we do it in underserved communities first, if it works in terms of the topography. And just, I know there were comments about electric vehicles. As an owner of an electric vehicle, I never think about where I'm going to charge every single minute that I drive my car. I actually have no issues on that. So I don't want us to act from fear. I want us to act from being educated and doing the right thing for our customers, doing the right thing for our environment. And I think this pilot is the right approach. So I just wanted to make those comments. And whenever there's a motion for this recommendation, I'll be more than happy to do so.
Yes, there's a motion on the floor. Is there a second?
I will say.
Was that from you, Mayor Schallis?
Yes. So I wanted to thank Mr. Jablowski and the staff for such a very thorough report. It was so informative. It really clarified a lot of the questions I had about going forward with a plan to implement a 100% zero emission transit system in the future, and the challenges that are out there in doing so. But also, I'm really glad about the rapidly changing technology that is going to move us there sooner rather than later. So that was my comment, and I had wanted to second the motion.
Thank you. Any further discussion? The motion, Mr. Roberts.
Followed by President Cole.
Council President, you want? Thank you. First of all, again, thank you, Stephen and Jack, and the staff. Really a good overview. Jack will probably remember when we started and got involved with electric cars, and we're much further along with the buses, but in the mid-90s, we had a mandate for electric cars, and the first of those that came out was something called the Impact, until General Motors realized that's probably not a good name for a car, Impact. And they renamed it the EV1, and I was fortunate to have use of one of the very first of those that was available. I remember, you talk about range anxiety, I had the idea I wanted to be the first one to drive an electric car in the Mother Goose Parade. And I was figuring out how many miles it was from my house out to the Mother Goose Parade, how long the parade was, how many times I'd have to stop, and then how I was going to get back. And I thought the last thing that electric cars needed was me getting halfway through the parade and have to be towed in front of everybody. So I actually made arrangements to be towed out there so I'd have a full charge to get through the parade. We've come a long way since then, and I think that the charts and the information have shown how not only have costs come down, but the electrical capacity has gone up, and hopefully that'll continue. I mean, if that trend continues, these ought to be free in a couple of years with a very large range. We know that's not going to happen, but it really is time for us to get a well-thought-out program in place. The motion is appropriate. I didn't know if implicit in that motion is for our direction, for our staff to obtain the services of a consultant to assist us not only in developing the program, but the things that have to combine with this for a longer term success. If that's needed, I'd ask the maker of the motion and the seconder to include that that we would include in the motion direction to staff to assess and to make a recommendation for a consultant to assist with this work.
Yeah, to assist with the implementation of the pilot, yes.
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 Mr. Jablowski, you listening?
Yes,
okay.
I am.
Okay.
That was, yeah.
I thought it might be, but I thought we ought to say it, that, you know, it's not, just jump off here, but let's get some.
We need some help who has broad experience.
That's no question about it.
To develop the kind of pilot that's going to produce the kind of data that we need to formulate ultimately a transition plan.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
President Cole.
Thank you. As my colleague said, this was, to me, one of the most exciting, impressive conferences that I've ever attended in my political career. And to say that about a bus is saying a lot. It truly impressed. The reason why I didn't have any questions is because they were answered at the today the conference. And so I just want to say, you know, since Mayor Salas asked the board to consider this and your request was answered, and we're here right now talking about it. And so that's, to me, also impressive. And I know that we have some challenges before us. We know that charging infrastructure, weight of the vehicles, financing, of course, as Council Member Alvarez brought up, it is an issue. Electricity is an issue, but the range is an issue. But I know that this team will work through that with a consultant. Will definitely work through that. I'm looking so forward to the pilot program in a couple districts. And my colleague said, you know, possibly District 9, District 4. Would be great because we are underserved districts, and I don't say disadvantaged, I say underserved. So if you would like to do that, we would definitely take full advantage of these buses in our districts. And it was also exciting driving in the buses. They were quiet, they were smooth, and I know that our maintenance people, our bus drivers, will get the proper training. I don't want to lose one employee, you're absolutely right, not one maintenance person, so I know that will be a transition and they will be trained. That's what was talked about at the conference. So again, I fully support this wonderful pilot program, and again, it would be great to have it in the two best districts in the city of San Diego, and that's District 4 and District 9, as well as District 8. Thank you so much.
Mr. Telesolis. Briefly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Goodness. Okay, so I too want to just support the motion, and I think that there's, again, the three issues, and I hear a lot of huffing and puffing, but this is really important, and it's taken a long time to get to this point. So the one thing that I do want to say is another reason why I mentioned the educational component is Sweetwater Unified School District just got $8.5 million to focus on STEM research, educational studies, and this may be a great opportunity. Again, when I'm talking about pipeline and if we're talking about technologies, how they evolve, this may be a great opportunity to just think outside the box, think about the high schoolers that are hopefully using this technology as riders, but also too maybe thinking about it as careers, whether they join an agency, government, nonprofit. So there may be that overlap and opportunity. $8.5 million, cherry on the top, you know, to think about, especially when we're looking at leveraging tax dollars. So thank you again, and call the vote.
Well, the vote's been called, so all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Thank you very much. And again, thank you, gentlemen, for being with us. We appreciate your being here.
Yes, thank you.
All right, we're going to have to make a few adjustments here, but we'll go right now to item number 31. And Paul, if you want to.
Yes, Rob. Yeah, I'll just briefly introduce it, and Rob's ready to make a quick presentation. I think it was about 2 years ago that we came to you. We've actually been involved in this for about 5 years, but 2 years ago we came to you with a naming rights agreement with UC San Diego for the UC San Diego Blue Line. That's been up for about 2 years now and has proven to be very successful. So we've been working on a second line, and I'm pleased to bring that to you today. It is with the Native American organization business, Sequan, who's very excited about naming rights on the Green Line. And so Rob is going to give you a presentation on the deal.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Yeah, I'll skip over some of this background that Paul just talked you through. But we've been working on the Green Line since the beginning of our arrangement with Superlative as well. So they've reached out to all of the organizations that are likely to be naming right partners. The Sequan Green Line, here are the terms for the first 5 years at $600,000 per year. In years 6 through 20, it increases by 3% each year. There's a mutual exit clause for both Sequan and MTS at 10 years. We've kind of based this on a 20-year deal, but at 10 years, we can reevaluate. They can exit at that 10-year mark. If we go to the 20-year mark, Sequan also has the option to extend the deal by another 10 years. So these are the gross payments that would be made to MTS over those terms at 10 years, is $6.25 million, 20 years, $14.5 million, and if it goes the full 30 years, it's $25.5 million. Just like the UC San Diego Blue Line, the assets we provide are some exclusivity. This deal has exclusivity for casinos and Native American business government for all the trolley assets. That's accepting the Blue Line. On the Blue Line, we are able to seek out casino advertising from the Las Vegas area. This pretty much excludes San Diego area casinos from trolley participation. We'll do naming rights at three stations, Santee, El Cajon, and Grantville. They will also get some bus shuttle operations at Santee, El Cajon, Grantville, and adjacent to 12th and Imperial. It's important to them, too, to convert people out of cars, get them onto their shuttle buses, and get them out to Sequan, both for employees and for visitors. They'll get advertising at those stations. Trolley wraps are a big part of this, so they get 6 trolley wraps per year. And I anticipate they're going to advertise more than the casino. They have a resort that's under construction there. They've got a golf course, and they have a growing entertainment business. So this isn't all about the casino. They'll get Green Line name on all of our signs, all of our printed materials, which include regional transit maps, our timetables for bus and trolley, all of the kinds of things that we print and promote our stations and our network of services. Okay, I think I've covered all that. Now, there is some foregone revenue that we're going to have to take because of this deal, the exclusivity of that. Currently, we're getting $105,000 per year from the Barona, who operates shuttles out of El Cajon and Palomar. So that will be foregone revenue because of the exclusivity. We also, our partners here, Superlative, are here, Miles Gallagher and Kyle Cantor, who put this deal together. They also are due a commission on that, and that's going to be negotiated. If we just go to the 10-year net to MTS, we're going to range from $4.7 million to $5 million. These are some of the examples that we're going to explore to pay off on the naming rights. This is a retaining wall we have going up the hill on I-8. That's visible to the freeway. They'll get some signage at our stations. This is the Grantville station. A Sequan Green Line banner can go there. It'll be probably more permanent than a banner made out of metal. Part of the deal, too, is all of the fabrication of signage is their responsibility, so we won't be any out of pocket of any of those costs. Here's an example of the trolley wraps. Those are very popular, as you know, with Comic-Con and others, so that gives them a lot of exposure along our trolley lines. And again, all of the printed materials will include a Sequan Green Line name on them. So they'll get millions. Well, I think our deal calls for like 240 million impressions a year that this deal will deliver to them. So our recommendation is to authorize the chief executive officer to execute the agreement. We made a slight change to the agreement, and that was passed out to you today. You would authorize the chief executive officer to execute that agreement with Sequan.
Is there a motion?
Yeah, motion approves.
Mayor Salas has a question. Yes. Before the motion.
I just wanted to know how this compares to our UCSD deal relative to the bottom line, the value of this compared to the value of UCSD.
Well, just strictly on terms, We're getting about 600,000 now from UCSD, right?
Do you want to?
But then when the blue line opens up, it'll be just under a million.
Right? Okay, so we're getting a lot more revenue from UCSD as
once,
a deal.
Once Midcoast opens up.
So we're getting more revenue from UCSD.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think that.
But the impressions are more along that line than they are along the green line.
That was my point. And the difference is you have UCSD, which is a nonprofit, and we have another organization that I'm just hoping that we're not selling ourselves short on this.
And you know, I think the market is what the market is. Mm-hmm. And we've been out for about 2 years selling this. The consultants have talked to a number of people about this opportunity. This is the best deal that we have. And that's why, I mean, we also negotiated when we brought this to the executive committee that if the interest in this sparks after 10 years, we have the ability to get out and rebid it.
One point of clarification too, the UC San Diego partnership is with UC San Diego Health, and that is a for-profit organization. So those funds are coming out of the university.
Okay, I have a motion from Mr.
Yeah, I had asked a question because I was concerned about Viejas and Verona. So that's the reason I'd got my question answered. And they were not interested, apparently. So that's why we're there.
Okay.
Mr. Alves and then Mr. Romney.
Thank you. The first 5 years, $600,000 a year, in terms of stops compared to going back to the UCSD healthcare deal, is it like proportionate to that? We have less stops on the green. Therefore, a little less revenue.
It's based primarily on impressions. So the impressions on the blue line are going to be about $340 million a year. This one's $320 million for UC San Diego blue line. About $240 million for this line.
Okay. All right. Foregone revenue question on, I understand the Verona shuttle loss. Would we be losing potential revenue from the wraps from like Comic-Con, which is like the biggest, I think, driver?
No, so the we would continue to have the ability to wrap all of the Comic-Con green lines. So the wraps that would be devoted to Saquon would be moved off the green line during Comic-Con.
Okay. And I am definitely not a fan of the retaining wall, super large Saquon green line impression. The City of San Diego's sign ordinance has there's no jurisdiction over signage on MTS property?
I'll let Karen handle that one.
MTS property is not subject to the City of San Diego sign ordinance. Those freeway visible signs, though, would have to go through and be approved by Caltrans to make sure that they comply with the Outdoor Advertising Act. So.
Okay.
It's federal law that dictates signage like that within a certain distance of an interstate.
And so it will require Caltrans approval of that. And we've been very open with Saquon that while they may like that, if Caltrans doesn't approve it, then it doesn't mean the deal's off. They understand that that's a possibility.
Okay, so that one is just an added bonus if it gets approved by Caltrans as part of the provided impression. So going to page 4, they're going to get the three stations naming rights. What does that mean? Is it now the Santee Saquon station or what?
Well, I've been having some discussions. So essentially, they do get naming rights at those stations. In the past couple of days, I've been talking with their marketing director and iterating that the geographic location is very important to us to communicate with clarity to our passengers as to where their destination is. So. They do get the naming rights of that, but we're going to work very closely to come up with names that make sense for them and for us.
And the limitations on the naming, is it just Sequan, or could they name it something else and go cut a separate deal with a sports drink or something?
The contract has no limitations in it, but their intention is to promote Sequan.
And they get all the revenue from the naming rights of these three stations?
We were getting revenue.
I think it would be a violation of our agreement if they tried to resell any. These are exclusive
to
Sequan.
They're not going to resell.
So they would not be allowed to go market any of the perks that they got from us.
Okay.
So.
And does the UCSD Blue Line have the same naming rights at stations?
Yes.
Which ones are?
They have Old Town and then the two on campus.
Once that comes on,
yes.
Online. Let's see. Oh, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed the first part of the discussion. I had to go out and thank our speakers for coming, all of them, including the Sierra Club. That you know, it's good to see everybody, and everybody's working together. This is exciting. I mean, the last one, we were talking about, okay, where we're going, how we're going to spend some money. We don't often talk about how we get money. And I hate it when we have to go through these things, we have to cut service. And what we're doing here is really unique. I don't know anybody in the country that's stepped off like we have with the UCSD and now with this. And this has taken countless meetings to achieve. And when you get to the end, it's funny because, as we saw with UCSD, when we got to the end, was another hospital that decided they all were all of a sudden interested, and I'm certain that all of a sudden there's casinos that are interested. Everybody was given an opportunity, and it was only Sequan that really stepped up to the line and said, we want to work with you, and you go through a long negotiating process. Our staff and Paul have done a really terrific job here. This is going to help us to pay for some of those buses and to do that pilot program. I mean, between these two agreements, you're going to have something, when they mature, like $1.5 million a year. Okay.
Is that a motion?
I thought there already was a motion.
Okay, might as well. Is that a second?
And that's fine. If you need a second or a third or anything else, you can have it.
Okay.
I'm excited about anything that, in a positive way, brings us money to do, expand the kinds of things that we want to do and not have to restructure to get there. So,
dare I ask, is there any further discussion before we vote? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to ask you as part of the motion on item 32, to waive the report, and Paul will give you a rundown on it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Samantha. If you could raise your hand, Samantha works for Karen and has spent a lot of time on this. But, you know, safety inherently is like our number one priority, both with our passengers and our employees and our property. And over the past, you know, we've had a very structured safety program with Trolley for a number of years with the PUC. On the bus side, we've also had a safety program, but we've really ratcheted up safety within the organization in the last year plus, to whereas both safety managers and both chief operating officers meet with me every month to go over accidents, to go over plans, to go over trends. And so it's really, and we've also gone through a big effort of communicating being safe and operating safe, and as you know, we've won some awards in that regard. There is a standard throughout the industry called SMS. It's called the Safety Management System, looked at by most people as the standard for the way to do safety, and it's an entire program. And the federal government has looked at this. They've issued some rules on it. They're kind of going back and forth on where to go, but SMS is a good program to have in place. One of the elements of it is that we have a policy adopted by the board of safety, and this is what that is. It's a very concise prescription of what the board should do. It's a very high level at board level. We're already working with Trolley to convert what we had
under CPUC to be in compliance with SMS. We're going to be doing the same thing with bus. So ultimately, we'll have a comprehensive SMS program. But we want to start with the board policy now, and that was attached. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
If not, I'll take a motion to approve. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. And that's with the waive of the formal report. Okay, we've got a couple of items here that I'm going to just defer to our next meeting. Comic-Con recap, the customer satisfaction report, because I think we want to take a little time to talk about that. If you're interested in the full report from Mike Thompson, we'll have to send that to the next meeting. But if you're willing to weigh the report and approve, it's an informational item. It is an informational item, so if you're willing to weigh the report on that, when Mike comes back, he doesn't have to repeat this one, but we'll give you an update that will be more meaningful and up to date. So if there's no objection, we'll waive that one. And
can we just approve without?
Yeah, well, can we approve without a formal report, I guess? I'll take a motion on that.
Just information. Okay,
fine. Yeah, just information, yeah. Okay. Okay, Chairman's report, just make it very brief. I was at APTA and fortunately was able to participate in the meetings with the bus companies, and as you can see from comments from the others, it was very worthwhile, and I'm glad to see us make these steps today. CEO?
I have nothing to report.
Okay, I'll take any board member communications, and then when we get into closed session, that'll be our last item of business.
Yeah, sure. The only thing I would add is that, as you all know, I believe that AB 805 was passed, or was signed by the governor, I think, last week, right? I've asked general counsel to review and to prepare a report to the board next month. So we'll come back to you with all of the changes and what it means for the board, and begin the discussion that you need to have in terms of election and going forward. So we'll lay that all out for you next month, and that'll give you an opportunity, if you so desire, to put together a nominating committee. And whether that happens in December or January, when the board composition changes, et cetera, you can have that discussion next month. So we'll lay that all out for you.
Okay, our next meeting date is November, when am I glad, 9th, is that right? Yeah,
November 9th.
Didn't have my glasses on. And we'll now go into closed session, and we will adjourn on reporting out.
Reporting out of closed session, item number 24A, conference with real property negotiators. The board received a report and gave instructions to negotiators.